past one, and there are many features that I would like to duplicate here. If you increase rent over 5%, relocation assistance would be required from the landlord, and that goes up with each percentage, because much like Brooklyn mentioned, we don't get raises of 10% or 20%. And some people I've known had their rent raised 50%. This has to stop. It's getting astronomical, and we need to have better boundaries. Next thing is that we do need to build more affordable housing, and we need to be spending our time and our money focused on building more affordable housing for the people in all of our districts throughout the city.
That was Chris Olson. This is Jonathan Tassini.
So as a member of my neighborhood emergency team, I've been part of many deployments for houseless people, both in the brutal heat of the summer and in the frigid temperatures of the winter. And I've seen that firsthand. I think one of the things we have to remind ourselves is that the crisis of homelessness isn't new. In 2 or 3 years old, this has been going on for decades, and it has to do with the lack of rent control. We can build all the nice, affordable buildings we want. If we don't raise people's wages, they will not be able to afford the rent. The Portland Metro minimum wage is $15.45 an hour. You can do the math. That's a poverty level wage for a family of four, as the federal government thinks of it. Even when people are working at what we think is a high minimum wage compared to the outrageous and immoral federal minimum wage, that is not enough to pay the rent. So I'm proposing a significant minimum wage raise, which obviously is a state issue, and we'll have to really fight for that, and generally to raise people's wages. And the second point is about affordable housing. I am very mindful of trying to build affordable housing, but that has to be paired with raising people's wages so they can pay the rent.
That was Jonathan Tassini. This is John Middleton.
I'm going to be brutally honest with you. I'm not a politician. I don't have a policy because I wholeheartedly disagree with the task sites and all that stuff in general. I think it's inhumane to pick people up where they're from, where they've formed a bit of community. Just because someone is a drug addict, just because someone is living on the street, they are a human being. I know it's an eyesore, okay? And it used to anger me back in the day, but it makes me want to cry sometimes. The conditions that I see in the United States of America, in Portland, Oregon, where I live, I don't care about a policy about temporary shelters. I don't think they should be a thing. Do I have a long-term plan? Yes. Do I have a vision? Yes. And it stems from compassion and humanity. And it doesn't mean that somebody else is getting rich. And I'm sorry, but it comes down to economics, and someone's making money off these task sites. Someone's making money buying tents, giving them to people, sweeping them, wasting $22 million of our hard-earned tax money to keep people on the street. It's inhumane and it's cruel. Meet them where they're at. Use the resources we have in this city. I have spoken to several nonprofits who are begging for the money, who have proven track records that can give us financial statements, and our city council and our county commissioners ignore them, don't give an opportunity. We have everything we need here to solve this problem in a humane and compassionate way.
That was John Middleton. Now this is Laura Stribe.
Living in St. John's and watching the Safe Rest Village go in was a lot of community discussion, a lot of heated arguments, and it is here, and the individuals that have been living in these spaces have a safe place to be. They are now finishing school. They are looking for jobs. They are getting jobs, and they are investing in their own lives to be able to move out of those spaces into more permanent housing. And those kinds of Safe Rest Villages are happening all around our city. They have a place to be. They do not have to worry about their stuff. They don't have to worry about their safety. They have wraparound supports. And so if we can replicate that as a temporary solution so that they can get their feet back under them in a humane way, then they are able to finish some schooling, finish a trade, get a job, feel secure in that, and move on from that space. Another thing we need to do is back up the river and look at our permitting system. the BDS just laid off 72 people in December. How are we going to get permits to build all these houses that we are supposed to require for the 6,000 people that we need to build houses for in our community when permitting takes 100 to 400 days? We don't have investments that can wait that long. We don't have people that can wait 400 days before something can get built. We need to bring those people back into their jobs so that we can get permitting going, so that we can then work with our community partners. Like, it's really encouraging to see Vision One, Albina One, and the Albina Vision Trust have these great visions for our community in building housing and thinking about that. We need more community partners like that. And I feel like that's what we need to do as a city, is look at our community partners.
That was Laura Strybe. Now, this is Jennifer Park.
I spent 6 years working in supportive housing in San Francisco before I came to Portland 10 years ago. Part of that was as the general manager of a 94-unit supportive housing hotel. The temporary housing life cycle, we need a housing-first harm reduction model where people are not restricted in order to get into a house. If you want to get clean and sober, if you need to get healthy, you need to have housing in order to do that. You need wraparound services. I fully 100% believe we need harm reduction models. And then once folks are in housing, they need all of the supports. We see people aging out of temporary housing and going back to the street because they didn't get the supports they need to be successful. Why put people in buildings if we're not going to help them be successful in those homes? Many people who signed leases in our supportive housing hotels had never signed a lease before. In addition, we need more permanent housing. I have a lot of ideas on how we can do that. Just last night, I posted on my website and sent out to my newsletter a housing study I did on commercial conversions, which is something that we have the opportunity to do here in Oregon, thanks to last year's legislative session, opening up these models. I also have harm reduction housing policy models coming out. Bottom line is people need full supports to be successful, and we need to change our expectations.
That was Jennifer Park. Now this is Ilana Pertlegini.
So I want to start with two things. First is housing affordability is a wage issue. We have to address wages as we address housing. Not instead of, but as we address housing. Two, people need stability. Whatever our solution is to homelessness, and there are many solutions, and frankly, right now, I think our problem is bad enough that we need to be doing all of them. People need stability. You need a place where you know you can sleep at night, where you can keep your things, where you know you can get a meal, if we want you to be able to do anything else to stabilize your life, get an education, get a job, find those other two meals. People need stability. So what do I think about the life cycle of our temporary housing that we have right now? First of all, homelessness is not a right now issue. It's an always issue. And we need to address homelessness right now and have a far smaller homeless population. But I am not going to stand up here and suggest that we are ever going to get to zero. Much of our current temporary housing is on plots of land that had actually been identified for long-term affordable housing. So we need to address our current locations so that we can free back up that land for our long-term needs for affordable housing. But as we do that, we are going to need to figure out what our long-term solution is for temporary housing, because that problem will not go away, that need will not go away. In terms of a long-term plan, I was talking to an affordable housing developer recently who was saying that what we think of as traditional affordable housing, that 60% of average median income, the people in that housing right now are working people, because housing is a wage issue. So I will just say 30% median income housing is all needing supports right now. There is so much we have to do to invest in those types of housing.
That was Ilana Pertlegini. Now this is Debbie Kitchen.
Wage issues are a huge part of our problem. I have been involved with economic development efforts throughout the metro area, and in my first career, I was a regional economist. And I will say that there are industries that we can support that provide better wages. and we need to have workforce development to help people earn those better wages, develop the skills. Some of them are in manufacturing, some of them are in tech, some of them are in healthcare. There are a lot of areas where we can improve our wage profile for our population and help everybody be able to afford housing. But the second part of it is having an adequate housing supply. We have, as has been mentioned, we've been underbuilding for decades. And we need to both lower the cost of housing. Part of that will be through permitting and coordinating our bureaus. We have 8 bureaus they have to go to for housing, and they don't work together or aren't coordinated. I think with the new form of government, eventually we'll see some results there that will lower our cost of housing. We need to focus on prevention. That is the best dollar we can spend, is keeping people from becoming homeless. We've increased the number of shelters. We've built affordable housing, and we're not keeping up because more people are falling through the cracks and are becoming homeless faster than we can house people. So prevention, that's where I would focus a lot of efforts. Workforce development, and skilling up our population, building more adequate housing, and then just having that continuum of supportive housing services to help people move from homelessness into long-term stable housing.
That was Debbie Kitchen. Now this is James Armstrong.
As a member of the St. John's Boosters Safety and Livability Committee, I've been on a lot of communication with the city when it comes to how they present these new ideas to the community. A lot of times what they do, they send an email, they say, guess what? We're doing this. How do you feel about it? And then we scramble together, have a meeting and say, we're not sure because you just told us about it. That kind of communication is classic city of Portland, how they like to present things to St. John's across the rest of the city. And it doesn't work because it makes the community feel anxious about what's happening. You're scrambling to get questions answered, and really you don't know what's going on. The task sites are successful in moving people through the system. They're not the answer, though. They are far more expensive than the real long-term solution. 5 years from now, we should not be expecting your community to just have to house people in small sheds. We should build towards a full, sustainable system for supportive services.
That was James Armstrong. Now this is Mark Kohler.
First of all, I think I'm the only one here on the panel who's living on a fixed income. I see folks whose hair is the same color as mine who are forced to deal with the fact that our income is not going to go up anywhere near this 10% baloney that they talk about as an annual increase as okay. No, I have a plan actually that I would present that if you are living on a fixed income, whether it's from Social Security or disability or other sorts of veterans benefits and things like that, that we can restrict the increases in your rent to the cost of living adjustments we get on our Medicare or Social Security. We have to protect the people who are housed now from becoming homeless. Another piece about the homelessness thing, let's think about it. You know who's doing all the good stuff? It's not the government. It's the faith-based organizations. It's the nonprofits. And it's the philanthropists. The last thing I want to talk about, the $650 million housing bond that you all voted for, it didn't take a single person off the street. All of those, all that money went to developers. It went to the big banks. So one of the things that I talk about is the creation of a municipal bank. So those resources that we're spending towards housing goes to us, not to big developers and not to big banks.
That was Mark Kohler. You've been listening to edited excerpts from the Portland City Council District 2 Candidates Forum held March 6 at St. John's Church in Portland, Oregon. In the interest of time and maintaining a focus on the questions posed, the candidates' answers have been edited for clarity and brevity. The full, unedited recording of the forum is available on our website at kbu.fm. Now, let's get back to the forum. This is moderator Seamus Linsky.
We have time for one last question. This one is, I am concerned about the toxicity of the area due to the CEI hub, tank farms, and a Superfund river site. As a city councilor, how will you address our safety and mitigate toxicity, especially with the danger of earthquakes?
This is Jonathan Tassini.
As a city council member, I'm going to argue for every single fossil fuel company having to require to take out risk bonds, which essentially means that we don't pay for anything that happens because of them, that they pay for any spills, pollution, any impacts on the community. Second, no more pipelines through here, okay? It's not a fast solution, let's be honest. I'm very aware of what lies beneath the sands there and what's in the tank. So I would commit to you to work with you and with the experts to, number one, make sure the liability is not on us, and no more pipelines through our city, and an attempt to try to figure out, and it's not going to be fast, to move that stuff out of the city.
That was Jonathan Tassini. This is Chris Olson.
We absolutely need to, I think, obviously just reinforce the infrastructure there. And then eventually, as we are moving ourselves off of fossil fuels, obviously removing that and restoring the waterfront. So it's going to be a very long process to do that. I don't want any more pipelines. I don't want to have this infrastructure continue to exist on that side of the river. It needs to be taken down and needs to be removed eventually as we transition out of fossil fuels into more clean energy. So that's, I'm completely for that. Let's tank those tanks and start over.
That was Chris Olson. Now, this is Mariah Hudson.
As a former sustainability officer and also emergency preparedness coach, it's not a matter of if, but when we're going to have the earthquake, and we need to be absolutely prepared for that. I think we need to start with emergency routes, ensuring that Columbia Boulevard, that people from North Portland have a way to get out, because when those tanks go, it's going to create the kind of toxic gas that threatens our whole community. And there aren't the hospitals and resources up here in North Portland that we're all going to need. So let's talk about how we would respond to that. And it's going to be at the neighborhood level. That's why the NET teams are so important. That's why our neighborhood associations still really have a role in our community in creating that kind of base democracy, because it's going to be your neighbors who help you respond to these things. Now, in terms of what would I do about the fact that there are tanks right now, it's going to be a long-term solution. It's going to require our city putting pressure on the state, getting funding to help move those, to decommission them over time. But we need the preparedness in our communities now. I have a track record of working with the Northeast Coalition of Neighborhoods, fighting Zenith, fighting air polluters, and bringing our communities together to do that. It's not going to just be at the city level. We can, through our permitting, we don't need to be counselors that renew permits. Let's get away from that. But it's going to be looking for that funding that pulls things together that can make that happen.
That was Mariah Hudson. This is Ruben Berlin.
So with those tanks, you are going to have to look at how to decommission them and move them and get it out of here. The bonds and the insurance and everything are great, but it really doesn't do anything for the immediate impact of an event. Being prepared to evacuate the area, having emergency kits, having emergency responses and a plan, having those be readily available as best as possible during, you know, any sort of emergency, whether that be an earthquake, fire, or any number of scenarios that can happen with those. So petitioning the state and the federal government to try and decommission them, move them, and then really have a policy where we're getting away from oil would be the best long-term policy for those tanks.
That was Ruben Berlin. Now, this is Brooklyn Sherman.
Just going to say it, Zenith is bad. We shouldn't have them here. And it's a chronic problem that's growing. They're getting three new pipes, thanks to the current city council. And things do not look like they're on the up on this issue. And a big part of that is Zenith, they're active. They pay attention to politics. If you don't think that they have someone probably paying attention to our campaigns, you're sadly mistaken. And we as a community, not just the city council, but everyone at the neighborhood association level and everywhere else in your groups, we got to actually talk about them. And I think a chronic problem with this issue is not enough people even know what Zenith is. And we really have to discuss with our neighbors, with our friends, with the guys at the pub, or whatever you go, hey, there's this company called Zenith. They have all these tanks. You've noticed them, right? they're bad. Because when you do that, even if the people on city council aren't all like gung-ho about chasing Zenith out of town, you, by being gung-ho about it, forces them to at least acknowledge the problem, which currently isn't going on.
That was Brooklyn Sherman. Now, this is Mark Kohler.
On Hayden Island, we have one way on and off the island. It's the bridge. And I can't believe that bridge is going to be replaced in the next 5, 10, who knows how many years that's going to take. If there is a quake, we're stuck. And I know other neighborhoods, St. John's and these other neighborhoods, are all facing that same thing. What are we going to do? In this country, we are wonderful at closing the barn door after the horse has left. None of the other things we've talked about threaten our lives as much as the catastrophe that is going to come. It's just a question of when. We're in a place that is not stable, right? And there will be a significant quake sometime in, maybe not in my lifetime, but in a lot of yours here, okay? And when it comes, it could come next week, it could come in 5 years. We got to be ready for it now and start doing things. And I really think it's wonderful that you're raising that issue as council members. We need to continue to raise that issue also. It is a federal problem. We're not gonna fix that. We don't have the billions it's gonna take to do all that. And the companies won't do it on their own because they're gonna find all kinds of legal ways not to do that until the catastrophe strikes. So we have to organize as an organization, as a state, as a city, as a region of the United States, because this is not just a Portland issue. This is Canada all the way down to Northern California. It's a big issue for all of us.
That was Mark Kohler. Now, this is James Armstrong.
I've been learning a lot on this issue. My job as a candidate is to be your voice. We are districted representation now. What I would strive to do is be in there leveling the playing field, because as we've discussed, the powers that be, they have their own people. They have their own way of doing things. They obviously talked to city council, and Dan's not here. Maybe we could ask them what they said. Maybe they said something really great. I doubt it. But what I can promise you is that I will listen to the community and I will represent you and I will help level that playing field with my background.
That was James Armstrong. Now, this is Debbie Kitchen.
There is a very high risk of an earthquake coming, and we do need to start getting prepared. Definitely, we need to start reducing our dependence on fossil fuels. That's something that we should be doing for multiple reasons, but also the CEI hub, those tanks, we do need to try to figure out how to move them or decommission them over time. And I think it is a federal responsibility. I think that's part of FEMA, that we should be tapping into those dollars. We have a lot of dollars in the state, but not nearly enough. So I would work with our city, our state, our county to try to address these issues. We are likely to be using fossil fuels for some time in the future so that we can reduce our dependence, but we can't eliminate it overnight. This is a long-term strategy. We need to keep working on it. And we need to make sure that the companies provide the liability that there really is there. There are caps in some of the current laws, and this had to do with big oil spills. They weren't required to cover all of the liability. So we need to make sure that all of the liability is covered. That won't be that much comfort at the time, but it'll help. And then reduce dependence and eventually move those, and with federal assistance.
That was Debbie Kitchen. Now, this is Ilana Pertelgini.
Our district particularly faces more of these issues than I think any other district in the city. Not only do we have CEI Hub, not only do we have the Superfund site right along the side of the district, not only do we have liquefaction concerns just about anywhere up the peninsula from where we're sitting right now, plus anything along the northern parts of the district the whole way along it. Not only do we have levees lining the northern part of our district, many of which are on the edge of failing. Luckily, we've got some resources coming for that from the federal government. The list goes on of places where this district in particular faces that nexus of environmental and safety issues. We need to be talking about those. They need to be a big issue in what we're talking about in this race. I want to talk specifically about CEI Hub, though. There are folks at the state and the federal government who are starting to work on that plan for decommissioning that hub. It's a long way out. But as a city councilor, I think one of the most important things we can do is make sure that our voices are active in that decommissioning plan when they start talking about where those tanks go next. Because they certainly shouldn't be on ground that's going to liquefy in an earthquake. And there certainly can be fewer of them as we move forward and decrease our dependence on fossil fuels. But we're not going to get rid of them altogether. We're not completely phasing out fossil fuels on a soon enough timeline that there won't be any tanks. So where are they going to go? Are they spread out? Are they all in one place? Are they all in District 2? I sure hope not. If I'm your city councilor, I will be standing anywhere I can to say they should not all go here. We can't be NIMBY about it, though. We can't say they should all go over there. We need to be figuring out where the least risky place is as we decommission those tanks. And I want to make sure that's part of the conversation.
That was Ilana Pertlegini. Now, this is Jennifer Park.
I think emergency management has been really put on the shoulders of individuals and community members. If you have the opportunity to prepare your house, to prepare your family for an emergency, that is a component that many people do not have the privilege to do. So emergency management really needs to be the responsibility of the government from the local, state, and federal level. And we're talking about the preparedness for the quake, which we all agree is inevitable at some point, and how our neighborhood is going to be prepared for that. What's going to happen? What are the potential crises, and how do we prepare ourselves to respond to that and support the community? And then also thinking about emergency management, like on a bigger picture, we have more and more issues with air quality around wildfire smoke every year because our temperatures are rising because of climate. How do we address that? We need to address our heat islands in the city so that we can help reduce our climate impact locally. And not only the heat, but the cold, right? It's been far too long put on neighborhood associations and really community members who have the ability to invest their own time and their own money in preparing our communities. And it's really the responsibility of the city and the state and the federal government to make sure that our neighborhoods are safe in any emergency situation.
That was Jennifer Park. Now this is Laura Stribe.
Thinking about those tanks that are across the river, we need to take a look at our environmental regulations that we have in place. I'm not sure what the city has as far as a plan for that right now, but we really need to see what plans are in place, what liabilities do they have, what infrastructure are they willing to invest in right now to make it a little bit safer, even though it's on ground that will liquefy? And where is that going to go eventually? Carmen Rubio and Dan Ryan approved the Zenith pipeline coming in, which is unfortunate because they made that decision on their way out. And the new city council is going to have to live with those decisions. They said it's not going to go through any neighborhoods, but any train track goes a block from my house. And we need to be very preventative in our environmental protections and really think about our infrastructure. And as a parent, I always think worst case scenario. So I think we as a council need to think worst case scenario and plan for that with the infrastructure.
That was Laura Stribe. Now this is John Middleton.
I think that the most important issue in all of our lives is our environment. I believe climate change is real. I think it's affected by the things we do. A lot of the things we do hurt and harm people. I don't know what to do with those tanks. I would be turning to the people that are like handing out the handouts and doing this stuff because they are much smarter than I am and they will know how to handle these things. We can work together and get this done. D2, I'm really proud of us. We're not NIMBYs. We have four, three in one coming in, of the task sites. And you guys don't complain about it. You ask serious questions. Why are you going to put another one when we don't have services? We live across the river from a liquefying oil spill, and everyone keeps talking about an earthquake, and I'm scared to death of fire. It was 115 a couple years ago. I'm not a great golfer, but on a good day, I could stand at Forest Park and hit my driver into the tanks. I'm more worried about fire, so this is a pressing issue. I could promise you two things. Anything that I do in city council would be done through a lens of environmental safety and how it affects us. It'll go through a racial lens, and I choose that because it's the most intersectional of all. And don't ask Zenith or nobody else. They can come. They ain't getting a permit out of me.
That was John Middleton. You've been listening to edited excerpts of a Portland City Council District 2 candidate forum held March 6th at St. John's Church in Portland, Oregon. It featured 12 of the candidates running for the 3 open seats in the district. We heard from candidates Jonathan Tessini, Christopher Olson, Mariah Hudson, Ruben Berlin, Brooklyn Sherman, Mark Coller, James Armstrong, Debbie Kitchen, Ilana Pertelgini, Jennifer Park, Laura Stribe, and John Middleton. One candidate and current city commissioner, Dan Ryan, was unable to attend. Seamus Linsky was the moderator. The responses from the candidates were edited for clarity and brevity. Find the full unedited recording of the forum on our website at kbu.fm. I'm Eric Leuschner. Thank you to Barbara Bernstein for her help on this piece, and thank you for listening.
This is Mark Sanford Gross, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to KBOO, KBOO, 90.7 FM, Portland.
KBOO's board.